Welcome to the 72nd episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. I'm excited for this episode as it is the first time in this show that we have touched upon the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm very excited to welcome first-time guest in discussing this topic, Professor Marvin Sweeney.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, my pleasure to meet you virtually, and my pleasure to meet your audience.
Great, great. And for those less familiar with Professor Sweeney, he is a professor of Hebrew at the Claremont School of Theology at Willamette. Did I pronounce that correctly? Willamette?
Willamette University.
Willamette. Ooh, I was not going that direction.
Willamette. Oh, they have a saying. Yeah. It's Willamette, damn it. So that if that helps you to remember it.
It's definitely helpful. Willamette University, Salem, Oregon. His PhD is from Claremont Graduate University, and he is the author of 16 volumes, such as Tanakh, A Literary and Theological Introduction to the Jewish Bible, Reading the Hebrew Bible After the Shoah, Engaging Holocaust Theology, and Jewish Mysticism from Ancient Times Through Today. So it's pretty broad. It's a pretty broad knowledge. Of literary output. I found out about Professor Sweeney through this article that he, or an essay article that he wrote on the Torah.com, a website I greatly enjoy, find very valuable. For those dedicated listeners, we also previously had Dr. Rabbi Zev Farber, previously based off of an essay he published on this website. This essay by Professor Sweeney is How the Temple Scroll Rewrote the Festival of Bikurim. Basically, we're going to get to this wine festival. So this is really what this episode is all about. This wine festival in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Just as a quick bibliographical point, this is not the first place this article by Professor Sweeney appeared. It's based off of a 1983 article, which goes into it much further. Sephira at Qumran, Aspects of the Counting Formulas for the First Fruit Festivals in the Temple Scrolls. So I'm happy to include in the show notes for anybody interested out there for further bibliographical information on that earlier essay. So Professor Sweeney, Dead Sea Scrolls, they were largely, if I'm correct, largely found, or at least the bulk of them, in the mid 20th century. Major discovery, which I suspect revolutionized the biblical studies field.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. But that wasn't it. It wasn't just the mid-20th century. It was even this year, earlier this year in the spring, it was announced they found even more, right? There were even further Dead Sea Scrolls.
Some fragments. They're basically small fragmentary readings, so they probably won't have that much impact. But they also add to the scrolls or to the manuscripts that we've got. Most of the scrolls are very fragmentary. But when the scrolls were first discovered in 1947 by Arab tribesmen, or I should say boys, who were shepherding their sheep down by the Dead Sea, one of them had a goat or a sheep that decided to jump into a cave and get away. And so when he threw a rock into it to get the animal to come out, he heard something shattering. What's that? And there were two boys there. They went in to see what had happened, and they found that their rock had shattered a clay jar, and there were some very ancient scrolls in it. They, of course, didn't know what they were, but they took them to their tribal leaders, who looked at them and took them to a Christian cleric, Mar Samuel, who then took them to Hebrew University and to the American Archaeological School in Jerusalem, now known as the Albright Institute. And they began to open them, go through the process of figuring out what they were. And we had seven major scrolls, largely intact, but of course deteriorated.
Yeah.
And as a result of that discovery, expeditions were raised to examine other caves in the region to see if there were more scrolls. And yes, there were. There were a total of 11 scroll caves. Some had just a few, some had many. Cave 4 had hundreds of manuscripts, and altogether some 800 manuscripts, thousands of fragments, because most of them were not preserved and sealed in clay jars, but were on the floor of the cave, had to be dug out. The bats and the rats had at them, water, everything that you can imagine. And so most of the scrolls are very fragmentary, but even with that, we still have major textual witnesses, both to the Bible, as well as some post-biblical literature that we know from the Christian canon, and texts that we had never seen before that were considered sectarian. But even with the sectarian documents, some of them actually had been known before.
And so I'm suspecting they're roughly 2 millennia old. What's basically the range of age on these documents when they were at least created?
Probably about as early as the 3rd century BCE, although they may have had exemplars from before that time, because we're not looking at autograph copies. We're looking at copies. And they would have gone to the 1st century CE because the site at Qumran was destroyed by the Romans in the Zealot War that starting 68, Vespasian and Titus marched their army down the Jordan River. They attacked the Galilee first and conquered it, marched down the Jordan Valley and attacked Qumran. It was defended. We found plenty of arrows, Roman arrowheads there. And the inhabitants either were killed, taken prisoner, or fled. Some of them ended up at Masada. And basically, the Dead Sea group, which we think is a group known as the Essenes, but we don't know what the Hebrew is. It might be a Sayot or something like that, a Saim. But there's still no certainty about what Essenes in Greek indicates. But the group was destroyed. The war they were waiting for, the war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, happened. But unfortunately, the sons of darkness being the Roman army and those that were considered wicked in the world, won, which is not what the war scroll from Qumran said was going to happen.
So speaking of scrolls, so this wine festival that we're going to discuss, so it's found in this document called the Temple Scroll. So what is this Temple Scroll? It sounds like it's a sectarian document by these Essenes. And sort of, can you contextualize this Temple Scroll for us?
Yeah, it's a work of Jewish interpretation. And the problem they're looking at is to think, looking at Deuteronomy is appears in it in its biblical form as an account of what God said to Moses, in which Moses is repeating that to the people of Israel before they cross the Jordan River into the land of Israel, or at that point the land of Canaan. But the Qumran group had apparently noted lots of exegetical problems, you know, like what day is, do you begin counting the Omer, for example? And so they basically used exegetical technique that looks very Zadokite or Sadducean, if you want to use the Greek term, to offer a work that employs exegesis by written Torah, which is what the Tzadokim are known for. As opposed to the oral Torah of the rabbis or their predecessors, the Pharisees, which may be derived somehow from Poroshim or Mefarshim or something like that. Wrote a rewritten form of Deuteronomy that appears in first person speaking form, God's words to Moses on Mount Sinai.
That's an interesting rewriting because Deuteronomy is really from Moses to the Jewish people or the Israelites.
Right.
But this is interesting to throw it into, place it into God's mouth.
Yeah. And what they've done is they've collected text on the various issues that they want to address, such as Sefirah for counting down to Shavuot, the Torah of the King. These are long sections that bring together various biblical passages and effectively rewrite the Torah. This is what God meant. Historically speaking, it might actually anticipate what we come to know as oral Torah in rabbinic Judaism. Of course, traditional scholars would argue that oral Torah was given to Moses on Mount Sinai. But the Temple Scroll from Qumran apparently attempts to write a manuscript of what that oral Torah would have been.
Hmm. Wow.
Now, I said they use it as an example of written Torah, mm-hmm. and it's very striking. At Qumran, we see elements that would represent a Zadokite, Sadducean, if you will, understanding of Torah, but we also see elements that would anticipate Rabbinic Judaism.
Hmm.
And it's a unique group so far as we know,
but
it represents one of the groups that was active in the late Second Temple period, Hellenistic period, if you will, was destroyed by the Romans. It's possible that some manuscripts were found during the Middle Ages. Some have argued that the Karaites, the Karaim, may have been motivated by manuscript finds from Qumran, or they might have been, in fact, descendants of the Sadducees. One of the Qumran scrolls that we have, the Damascus document, was actually known in an earlier or in a different form. When the Cairo Geniza was discovered, the Zadokite fragments there showed great correspondence with the Damascus document from Qumran. They're different recensions. But somebody knew that document in the Middle Ages. It was known in Egypt, and it shows up at Qumran. Some have speculated, I have to stress, this is speculation, that maybe someone made a manuscript discovery from the caves by Qumran, and that this is where we got the Zadokite fragments. Of course, it's always possible it came from elsewhere. We don't get a written history.
Yeah. So going into the Torah scroll, or the the Temple scroll, I'm sorry, the Temple scroll. So you mentioned the way that they deal with Deuteronomy. Now, what struck me from your article, and of course we're going to discuss this, but from a sort of a 30,000 foot perspective, is they try to blend or try to work together the stuff from Leviticus 23 with the stuff in Deuteronomy when it comes to the sphere counting time, right?
And so
they sort of blend in and weave these things in. So how do we get to a wine festival? I'm sure listeners of the show are really fascinated. I just want to clarify for the listeners, there is no wine festival stated in the Torah. But for this sect, this Jewish sect, back then, they came up with this based on these biblical texts.
Well, the structure of the scroll would originally apparently have had a discussion of what the temple looks like. That's missing. All we get is a little bit of discussion of the courtyards, but it's sort of patterned in a way on Ezekiel 40-48 as well. But as you already know, Ezekiel gives a description of the temple, and then it goes in the halachot. Here we get the halachot. They use Deuteronomy as the basis, but with Deuteronomy, you oftentimes have texts that don't give us specificity. For example, when you think about Sephira, in Deuteronomy, you've got the text in Deuteronomy 16:9 and following that are going to talk about the various holiday calendar. And
there are some listeners who are very familiar with this and some less so. What is this? There's a harvest cycle, right, that starts basically Passover time and then continues for 49/50 days and then yielding a harvest festival.
You get three, or actually four, basic legal texts in the Torah. You've got Exodus 21 through 23. That includes instructions for observing the festival of ingathering, Asef, as they call it, which is Shavuot. You've got Leviticus 23, which is a festival calendar. You've got Numbers 22 to 23, which gives you another set of instructions. And you've got Deuteronomy 16 and 17, which gives you a fourth set. And they differ in some cases, or they don't give you a full specification of how to observe the particular holiday. And so the Qumran writers, or whoever wrote this scroll, tried to put these four texts together in such a way that they could make sense out of them and determine what do the texts mean and how do we observe the divine command to observe this holiday. Mm-hmm. So while they're motivated by Deuteronomy, the text they use as their base text for Sefirah and Shavuot is Leviticus 23, which is going to start by telling you that you shall count off 40, the text is going to read in English.
Seven full weeks or seven complete weeks.
Yes, seven complete weeks. Mm-hmm. And they'll specify seven complete weeks. First day of the month, you shall, first day of the month, you have deserve a complete rest. And that you start the counting of the Omer on the day after the Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Well, what do they mean by that? And that becomes one of the problems they're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Does the Shabbat mean, number one, it's after a Shabbat itself? Does it refer to the festival or what have you? Mm-hmm. So that's one problem. The other is, well, what do we mean by first fruits? And Leviticus 23 will talk about a grain festival. But you've got other texts in the Torah, Numbers 18, Deuteronomy 18, that will speak about bikurim, first fruits of grain, wine, and oil. And so what the temple scroll does is it tries to solve this problem. What do we mean by first fruits? So they note there's a 50-day countdown from Pesach at some point to the festival of wheat. And so they have that. But then after the festival of wheat is over, they count down another 50 days. We've got a festival of wine. And then after wine, they count down another 50 days and you've got a festival of new oil, which fits logically both with the fact that the Torah mentions all three of these products as having, as being first fruits, number one, and number two, it's going to correspond to the sequence of the agricultural season in which you harvest wheat at certain points when it's ready to be harvested. Mm-hmm. You start bringing in the fruit harvest, grapes, olives, we'll stick with grapes for wine. And then the olives ripen at a later time in the season and they take account of that. And by the time you finish, you've got a 150-day festival and then you get a wood festival that is mentioned in Ezra Nehemiah.
Oh, wow.
They give you instructions on that. And by the time we're done with that, we're just about 3 days short of Rosh Hashanah or the festival of Teruah, as they understand it in the temple scroll. So they give you basically complete late springtime through summer observance for nearly half the year.
Yeah. So basically from the beginning of Passover all the way through Shemini Atzeret.
Yes.
So all of the festivals, and then there's the winter, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it rains. And then in the spring, you do it again.
Wow.
So they're basically defining holy time, expanding it from what we see written in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing it through a form of exegesis, as what did God really mean by this?
Mm-hmm.
And they're using written Torah to develop this completely new system that we don't see unless we dig like they did and draw the same conclusions that they did in their interpretation, trying to solve the problem. What does God want from us? And what must God have said to Moses on Sinai?
Mm-hmm. And also the Bikurim, it's why just the Bikurim for wheat, these first fruits and offering them and celebrating them. Why not also, like you said, 50 days later, the wine, 50 days after that, the olives.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything special? There's nothing beyond what they would observe for, let's say, Shavuot, right? For the wheat harvest festival and those first fruits, it would be something similar. They would somehow offer up wine. I don't know. Maybe they offer. I don't know. Would they offer?
Well, sacrifices? You're allowed to drink it. Wine offerings we get at Sukkot. Mm-hmm. And at least this is the rabbinic system. We don't know much about the rituals that they actually practiced. We don't see examples of their worship service, much like it's the same problem we've got in rabbinic Judaism. Mm-hmm. When you read the Mishnah, we don't always get a full description of what a Shabbat service looks like. We get some information, but otherwise it becomes what the minhag or the practice that we develop. Mm-hmm. They must have had their own, but number one, they didn't have a temple at Qumran. they had been expelled from the Jerusalem temple. Mm-hmm. They write about this in various of their other documents, but they saw themselves as essentially the keepers, if you will, of the tradition that would be reinstituted once the temple was purified and mm-hmm. essentially made kosher again so that they could move back in and resume what God wanted for temple observance. Problem mm-hmm. is, we don't know how they worshiped, say, on Shabbat mm-hmm. or on the holidays. We get these texts of instruction, but as you know, the Torah doesn't tell you everything about that.
Mm-hmm. Hey there, I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. I wanted to break in and give you a sneak peek into next week's episode. It features Professor A.J. Berkovitz. Here's a sneak peek.
This wine that we begin the Seder with is not just about Kiddush. It's not just a ceremonial prefunctory ritual that allows us to begin the meal. No, like it's actually part and parcel of the joy of the holiday. And let's be clear, Purim aside for a moment, but Passover. Pretty freaking joyous holiday.
I hope you enjoy that sneak peek into next week's episode, and I hope you come back for that as well. Going back to this wine festival, because that's what I'm really fascinated by. So the timing occurs on the third day of the month of Av, which is kind of fascinating. I mean, obviously, this is prior to the rabbinic literature, mm-hmm. so it does, because I know rabbinic literature, the ninth of Av is a really devastating, tragic day. So it's a time of mourning, and the rabbis later say once the month of Av begins, we decrease in joy. But before that, before the rabbis, we have this, which is the third of Av becomes in this, you know, this continuing 50-day harvest cycle becomes a rejoicing day, the third of Av. And I mean, I did mention earlier, if there are any special things, obviously there's some sort of wine libation that would be offered as part of this wine festival. Mm-hmm. I imagine that would be the at least the focal point, I suspect, as far as, I don't want to say liturgically, but at least practically, as far as sacrificially, that would be a huge focus, is actually dumping mm-hmm. out, pouring it out for God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and basically doing that to thank God for it, which is what the offerings are for.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I also see in your article that it's also the priest drinking there first. Mm-hmm. So that the priests get, they get first dibs, as it were. They get first, mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine it's unfermented wine. And so it would pretty much just be grape juice, right?
They're talking about tirosh. I mean,
right. It's tirosh, right? This for listeners out there, this term tirosh actually is semi-familiar to some of you, as it appears in the second paragraph of the Shema of this tirosh, for listeners out there, tirosh, it's part of a package of these three things, tirosh, chav, yitzarecha. So it's these three things that commonly appear, I don't want to say in tandem, but in trio, as it were. I think at least a half dozen times that they appear in trio in the book of Deuteronomy, right? So it's almost like a common refrain for good reward is these good reaping. So the priests drinking there first, and then the Levites after them get to drink this new wine, then the princes of the banners. And then after that, everybody else shall begin to drink new wine and to eat grapes and the unripe fruit from the vines. Mm-hmm. And then really fascinating, actually, I found this particularly fascinating. I mean, all the drinking of this new fresh wine is super exciting. Mm-hmm. In addition to, like, God obviously gets first dibs with the libation. Then after that, the priests, the Levites, the princes, and then everybody else eventually. There also is this aspect of atonement that somehow this, I don't know, maybe it's the eating. I don't know if it's the sacrifice, the libating, but somehow all of that is also meant to atone.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. There's not so much when you see the wine libations and whatnot, and yes, the term kaper is used there. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that they feel that they're somehow committing some kind of a sin for which atonement is necessary by drinking wine. It actually, I would think, comes out of what's stated in Numbers 17 and 18. That the role of the priest or Aaron and the Levites mm-hmm. Is to atone for the sanctuary. Well, what does that mean? Okay. Does the sanctuary sin somehow? It's a sanctuary. But rather, it has to be koshered, or basically properly purified for service. That's what they're doing with the wine, is in effect what their understanding of atoning in dealing with produce, such as, you know, the wheat, the wine, and the oil, is to, in effect, what they're doing is what we would call koshering it, by presenting it to God, because God, of course, is the absolute king. And the whole sanctuary structure is based on the image of a royal palace. And then they go through the sequence, the priests that stand before us and before God, and serve as our go-betweens, holy go-betweens, if you that then make sure to give proper honor to God by presenting God with the wine first. Then they do it, and then they pass it on to the rest of Kalal Yisrael. And then from there, we've got the wine for the coming year. Part of the issue, I would suspect, is that they were concerned with the fact that after a year, you want to have new wine, new oil coming in, because they don't have refrigeration, things go bad. And so they also want to make sure that what they're eating is proper, as understood from a standpoint of holiness, but also that their wine's not going to turn into vinegar or something. So they store it properly and use it, and then prepare for the next year, for whatever comes next. I don't know that they have the sense of vintage wines that we might think about today, but they do have proper storage.
Yeah, I trust them that they knew what to do with wine.
I mean,
it sounds like almost like a clearing out or a flushing out of the sort of the libation aspects of the grape juice / wine.
Hey, I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. It's not over yet. Stay tuned. Don't touch that dial. I wanted to see if you have any ideas, suggestions, whether it's for this particular show with guests, topics, or anything else, as well as anything beyond the show. Do you have other ideas? Maybe it's a trivia night with swag. I don't know. Ideas, I'm open to it. You can email me at drew@jewishdrinking.com, and I'm looking forward to hearing that. All right, thank you so much, and now back into the episode with Professor Sweeney.
I'm curious, what is the Wood Festival?
No one seems to know.
Oh, it just sort of gets mentioned in Ezra Nehemiah, and then that's
it? Yes, there's a collection for wood. They need something, you know, to use for burning at the altar and whatnot. And it's produce from the world of creation, but they don't do much to develop it. And of course, the text is fragmentary. It's not mentioned in the Torah, at least not that I'm aware of. But the Qumran group picked it up and basically made sure that there was an observance for it. So not everything is based on Torah from the standpoint of the temple scroll, because they're bringing in prophets as well as the writings and whatnot, and some things that we don't know about, and some things that we do, because, I mean, going back to the comment you made earlier about the third of Av, one thing to remember about Qumran is that they weren't using the same calendar that we were, that we use.
Oh, how so?
They were using a solar calendar of 364 days that is known in biblical texts. I mean, some of the reconstructions of the times that are presented in the Torah presuppose a solar calendar, 364 days, which means that the dates of the Jewish calendar fall on the same day every single year.
Oh, wow.
Whereas we use a lunar calendar that appears to be derived in part from Babylonia, which is where we get months like Mar Cheshvan. But there was apparently an Israelite solar calendar that was in use during the Iron Age or biblical times, however you want to describe that, and it changed at some point. In fact, the origins of the Qumran group are tied up with that temple change. There, during the period of the Hasmonean revolt against the Seleucid Syrian Empire that we celebrate with Hanukkah. This is apparently the period when the leader of the Qumran group, who's known only as Moray Tzedek, righteous teacher, was expelled from the temple.
Oh, wow.
And went out to Qumran down by the shores of the Dead Sea following the command of Isaiah, go out into the wilderness and wait for the Lord to act. And some of the Qumran texts speak about persecution by a wicked priest who comes out to Qumran on the day of Yom Kippur to persecute the righteous teacher. And interpreters looking at this have reasoned that in the Qumran text, including the temple scroll, we have a solar calendar, whereas the calendar we use in rabbinic Judaism is lunar, and that there must have been a calendrical issue of a change in calendar. Most interpreters, and I think they're correct on this, argue that the wicked priest must have been one of the Hasmonean brothers, Yonatan, the brother of Judah the Maccabee, who of course was killed in battle. Yonatan appears to be the one who was involved in apparently displacing whatever the priestly family had been. And we know from books like Maccabees how the Seleucid Empire had done this and replaced figures such as, he's known in Greek as Onias, but would be Hanania, gets displaced as priest, and then other priests are put in his place. But apparently a Jewish priest was involved in this somehow. Yonatan seems to be the candidate. And part of the Qumran group's standpoint was that the temple needed to be purified because the priests in the temple were not acting correctly to ensure the sanctity and the kashrut, if you will, of the temple. And that what they saw, they were preparing for the day when they would come back and essentially engage in a holy purge, resanctify the temple, and it would then become the basis on which knowledge of God would spread throughout the world. This would be the war between the B'nai Or versus the sons of light versus the B'nai Choshech, the sons of darkness, that would include the Romans, all the evil Gentiles of the world, and all the evil Jews of the world, which they apparently saw as groups that cooperated too closely with the Hellenistic monarchs. I mean, Yonatan had certain types of relationships with the Seleucid monarchs during the course of the war. He was eventually lured into a trap and assassinated by them, leaving only the last surviving Hasmonean brother, Shimon, was the one eventually to become high priest and declare an independent Jewish state from the Seleucid Empire. But it was not without its cost. Part of it was that you had this controversy going into the temple priesthood. And remember that the Hashmonim, the Hasmoneans, were actually not from Jerusalem. They had gone out to the outskirts of the land, Modi'in. I mean, we've got a new city, Modi'in, now. But they started in Modi'in and started the revolt and eventually became the priest of the Jerusalem temple.
Going back to the temple scroll, is there much else that it talks about the wine? Just in general, beyond this particular wine festival, how does it deal with wine more broadly?
I don't really see a whole lot that it deals with wine. We have our concepts of kosher wine in rabbinic Judaism. And of course, there's all kinds of controversy about what to do about that, depending on which movement in Judaism you're affiliated with. I mean, the conservatives, to my knowledge, have been more lax about kosher wine. Reform Jews don't worry about wine at all. You see at least some concern with the wine festival that we have as part of Bikurim, that you have to make atonement, as we saw what the language was. And that means that wine has to somehow be koshered in order to make it usable by Jews from the standpoint of the temple scroll. But I don't recall seeing much more than that in terms of wine. It's a holy offering, so it's going to be offered at the temple someday. Then, of course, you know, there has to be some sense of kashrut associated with it, and that's where you get the kippurim that we see in this text, because the temple's holy. What then becomes proper to offer at the altar? And the Hasmoneans had some problems with that. One of the later of the Hasmonean high priest, who also took the title of king, was pelted with citrons at Sukkot, in part because he was not considered to be a proper priest. And there were questions about his observance. But it goes back to a narrative that's told about the Hasmoneans, that one of their ancestors had been held captive in Rome for a period of time. And there was a question whether they were really of priestly descent. You see this narrative in rabbinic literature. You've got it in rabbinic literature. You've got it in Josephus and possibly elsewhere. There was actually quite a bit of opposition to the Hasmoneans in later periods. When you get to Alexander Yanai, this is the figure we're talking about. That's when you begin to see in the Qumran literature and in other Jewish texts from the late Hellenistic period, a resurgence of the notion that we need an ideal Davidic monarch. When you look in into the period following the building of the temple, say under the Persian period, there's not a lot said about the Davidic monarch, but in the Qumran text, that issue comes back, and it comes out largely because of dissatisfaction with the Hasmoneans. Yeah, so, you know, we Jews argue constantly. This is where you see, this is where you see some of it coming out.
For sure, for sure. All right, Professor Sweeney, thank you so much. I've appreciated this talk, these insights on this wine festival from the Temple Scroll. Do you have any projects or books you would like to promote or share?
Sure. I've written 16, so there's plenty of them around. My most recent one is on Jewish mysticism that essentially was written to give some credence to the notion that many of the biblical visionaries actually anticipated what becomes later Hekhalot visionary text and develops ultimately into Kabbalah during the Middle Ages. So I've given a much broader understanding of the development of Jewish mysticism. I'm currently writing commentaries on Samuel and Jeremiah. Jeremiah is particularly important because he's the prophet who tells you the most about himself, and he's the one who is a witness to what constitutes a biblical instance of what we might call today Shoah, not to try to claim that Shoah is comparable to anything else, but he lived at a time when he got to see the temple destroyed. He got to see his people taken into exile, including himself against his will. And he's the one who tells you the most about how he feels about this. In fact, when you look at Jeremiah and his sense of emotion, you see some of the roots of Kabbalistic thinking about especially Lurianic Kabbalah, that there's conflict within God. When God creates, according to Lurianic Kabbalah, that unleashes forces of evil into the world. One sees that conflict going on in Jeremiah, who does not want his job as a prophet or to see his people exiled and destroyed. And yet he does it at the instance of God. God insists you'll do and say what I tell you.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Sweeney. This has been really great, and thank you so much, and L'chaim.
Thank you, L'chaim to you.